order. That's Gail and Monica and Jamila, who's also you're going to hear from today. We have nothing to disclose in terms of financial commercial interests, but we do have other kinds of relationships. They are beloved friends, your beloved friends, and they are my mentors and colleagues, including and especially in the Food Dignity Project. It's a five-year endeavor to figure out how to build sustainable community food systems for sustainability, equity, and ending food insecurity. We're in our fourth year, and I have a relationship with Jamila that goes beyond that, and it was actually her letting me follow her around and work for her that helped inspire this work, which has both an ethical stance about involvement is a ethical imperative of people most affected should be involved, as well as a scientific hypothesis that involvement will lead to better outcomes. But today we're going to focus in particular about our stories about how CBPR has increased dramatically the rigor of our work, starting by talking about how that goes against prevailing wisdom and defining rigor. So these first two quotes are things that we have heard at community CCPH kind of community-based research groups that CBPR makes academics cringe and that there's a compromise between CBPR and rigor. Somehow, as in this paper, the idea that you can't have a clean mind of rigor or that somehow the dirty hand of actually doing real work is going to harm that. There are several non-rigorous assumptions in that dominant story. One is that only researchers care about the truth, which of course is not true. University-held knowledge and ways of knowing are superior, also not true. And that community participation in research contaminates it rather than illuminates it. And I think I'm talking to the reason you're here. You probably are on board that those are not true. Which is to rigor being about finding the truth, right, or truth. I think it's a general agreement that that's what that it's about. Through objectivity, a willingness to let go of things you hold factually very much wish were true, and also through a systematic method. I will point out here that there are other ways to get to the truth that aren't about rigor that can also get to truth and knowledge, but we're going to focus on the rigor one. The objectivity part of rigor is often framed as being distant, neutral, shedding your identity history, and having a view from nowhere. We also agree in this room the bottom three are totally impossible. You cannot walk away from yourself. You cannot have a view from nowhere. You have no view. Everyone can be distant. Distance is possible. And in social theory, sometimes they use this, they take a physics principle and turn it into this idea that you can have a view from nowhere. You get far enough away somehow that you're still somewhere, and if you're out there, you're so distant, you can't see what's going on in the community, and you have more rigor mortis than rigor at that distance. And as a method, rigor generally, the method in scientific rigorous research often has these steps. You can break them down differently. We're going to talk about how CBPR contributes to each in our personal experience, including in a randomized control trial, which is often held up as a gold standard in terms of research design. So, how CBPR contributes to strong objectivity and to rigorous method. I'm going to qualify the objectivity with strong objectivity, which is a notion that Daniel Harding developed, where essentially, instead of pretending you can have a view from nowhere, that the way you get to the truth is you have multiple standpoints. It's kind of like a triangulation, if you will. And the metaphor of blind people feeling different parts of an elephant, I think, is a good one for that, where individually no one person could describe the elephant, but collectively they have the truth of the animal. And that marginal standpoints are particularly valuable in achieving that truth, or seeing that truth, including W.B. Du Bois's notion of double consciousness is a very much an outside or marginalized standpoint for providing a bigger part of the true animal. Audre Lorde, in particular, her essay in that book, You Can't Dismantle the Master's House with the Master's Tools, that sort of multiple standpoint, which also echoes the famous quote by Einstein about you can't solve problems by using the same thinking that created them. So in Food Dignity, we have many, 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 many standpoints. We have five community partners, four university partners. Gail, as you heard, is head of Feeding Venerable Valley, director. Jamila, whole community project. Monica's at Cornell. I'm at University of Wyoming. So many organizational standpoints. And we get together. This is the Women of Food Dignity when we got together in Wyoming. It was event. We're not allowed in that picture. They could take the photo, though. or us in New York, in East New York. So we come together and bring our multiple standpoints together to figure out how to solve food insecurity and build community food systems that work. And then each community organization networks with other community organizations, both within the project. Gail brought together also Blue Mountain Associates and Wind River Indian Reservation there. That's some of the photo voice work they've done. And Jamila has, for example, brought folks to Detroit. So we learning from Detroit work in the food system and bringing that back to the communities, but also to Food Dignity as a project. And then the other layer of expertise in the work is the community members and citizen leaders that each of the partners works with. For example, these elders in Laramie, Gail always says, taught her how to run her food sharing program. And that wisdom and expertise and standpoints brought back. So that's a strong objectivity part. So for rigorous method in these four phases, I'm going to go through each one with an example from each. One is, what's the question? What's the research question? And of course, community participation in this one key part is identifying important questions as opposed to just a good research question that it doesn't matter to anybody if you answer it or not. And I would say this is a socio-ecological model, which I'm sure a lot of you have seen. Academics tend to like to focus right down here in the individual interpersonal research questions, because it's sort of like that joke about a guy looking for his keys under the lamplight. I'm like, oh, did you lose your keys here? No, I lost them over there, but here I can see. You know, if you want to find the keys, you might not be able to do a randomized controlled trial to find your keys. You might have to adopt some more complex methods. And food systems are definitely an example of where, you know, that central individual focus doesn't work. And so this gets a lot more complex. And to speak to that complexity for a minute.
This is what complexity looks like in Tompkins County, using a pathway model to map out the, a traditional logic model. So I'm really not interested in these work. I work right in the community. But in this model here and this display, it is intentionally very complex, because what it does is it represents a process across time. And it's a process that involves developing relationships. And it leverages resources, because I've contacted other foundations in addition to the resources with Food Dignity to invest in the community, to build capacity, and it is deliberately driven by a value of mutual respect. It also acknowledges the community context, the place and space, the history in our community when we're going in and working with community members. It reinforces relationships across time, and it leads to this honest, sometimes gut-wrenching respect, that process that leads to mutual respect. It can be very humbling, and is very humbling, and it's challenging. One thing that I can say is that in this process, embedded in all of that, is the investment into the community to develop the capacity of people on both the community side and on the academic side to actually work together. And I heard that echo. That was like, yay! And in short, this represents the rigor and the complexity of this CBPR research.
Can you read all that?
Yeah.
But without that kind of insight, you can't capture that level, of course, without people on the ground doing the work. And it was very generous of Jamila to spend time with Monica to turn a logic model into something much more complex and deeper that more accurately represents the incredible work that Jamila does. It needs about five more dimensions, probably. So that's an example of research identification, and we'll come back to that again, actually. But in research plan and design, a few examples from our work. One of the things that were, one of the research questions coming from some community partners was, how much do gardens produce? Do they produce real amounts of food? They're great for lots of other things we know, but how much food do they produce? So we identified that as a research question in Food Dignity, and we're measuring harvest of gardens. And so in Laramie, with Gail, feeding Laramie Valley, she pulled together, for a pilot and then a larger project, some leader gardeners to help to design the study about what data that we're going to collect and why. And I'll point out just one piece of that, was that the gardeners said they don't want to just measure what they harvest, they want to say what they do with it. And thank God they did that, because we found out that gardeners share, in Laramie at least, about 30% of everything they harvest. Which means gardening is impacting other people, and imagine if everyone shared a third of their groceries. Right? We would know that if they hadn't to help design that as a part of the research question and plan. Another example is actually we are co-designing with Feeding Laramie Valley and with Blue Mountain Associates in Wind River. This is the Wind River meetings to co-design a randomized controlled trial to on the health impacts of gardening. So we're co-designing it, and we go up to Wind River and hand out potential survey questions for everyone to go over, including community health workers who are going to actually administer the survey. And two examples from that. One, they said, community health workers, like, do you want to know the household size of the standard survey questions we asked? Or do you want to know how many people eat in the household? Because that's a totally different number.
Yeah.
And, okay, so apparently he asked both questions, and we do, and did. And will. And then the other, another example from that was there were a whole bunch of questions. They said, yeah, I wouldn't ask that question. I won't. If you ask me to ask that question, I will either, as we have done with other people who, researchers who have given us surveys, and we say, yes, we'll administer them. If we don't like a question, we either don't ask it at all and put in our own answer, or we change the question and then put in that answer, which means the data is very much not rigorous. It's junk. And often the researcher probably doesn't even know. So this co-design process helped us develop appropriate questions that would be asked the way we phrase them together. And then finally, in analysis and interpretation, we're really moving into that phase now in our work. But earlier in the case study work, community part is we're looking at our initial case study data. We're doing storytelling, essentially, rigorous storytelling about each project. And that it's really not the food system that's at the center of this work, it's people who are at the center of this work. And academics tend to put the food system in the center and somehow people are around it, like in one of those diagrams I showed earlier. The people are at the center, and especially leadership development is at the center. And having made that interpretation and implication, we've gone back and designed small, but we reallocated some resources to invest in leadership development and ask research questions about how to do grassroots leadership development. And, for example, that funding was used, Gail and Blue Mountain Associates used that to come together and bring their leaders together. And that's part of our, so that goes back to another research question identification. Another example of that was the team GROW, Gardener Researchers of Wyoming, who are measuring their harvest. They, after seeing how much food they were producing, which is on the scale of a commercial farm, even though we're at 7,200 feet and have 36-day growing season, it's amazing how much people were producing in their gardens. The next question was, well, water is very expensive. How much water are we using? So this past summer, we measured water use, and we're going to take the harvest data on water use, hopefully for policy change, to support, to subsidize water use for growing food. So contributes to rigor by providing multiple marginalized standpoints and pieces of knowledge, a more commitment to finding the truth, and most importantly, relevant and important truth is a huge contribution, and essential contribution to every part of method. I will also, it's a whole other topic, but of course, academic research is not necessarily rigorous either, and rigor is often used as a tool not to seek truth, but to control money and control what questions are asked, to silence and exclude. And probably a worst-case example of that would be just PD study. Right? So it's a warning that also that rigor should always serve what's right, not just in what's true, but what's right and what's ethical. And this is second. Thank you.